Welcome to the second part of the Warships Pod chat with Dr. Gary Blackburn and Dr. James Bosbotanis. And this time we look at the UK's defence budget and the so-called black hole that it has, which means that key programmes at a time of rising danger at sea and generally geopolitically may not be funded. We also consider again the contours of a new Cold War, which at the moment is burning pretty hot. So let the discussion begin. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at the National Audit Office report on the defence budget, which does have naval aspects and comes at a time when the Royal Navy is basically getting rid of older frigates because it may have to refit them, and that costs money to make them capable of dealing with threats like the Houthis and others out there, and also has a bit of a recruitment crisis in getting the people that it needs to send more ships to sea. At the same time as the Royal Navy is building new frigates in Scotland, the Type 31 and the Type 26, and trying to bring into service vessels for ocean surveillance. So I've had a quick look, but I mean, I'll rely on you just to give me an overview, because I think you probably have got more of a handle on it than I have. But when you look at the naval side of the National Audit Office report on the defence budget and how it's got another massive black hole where it can't really afford all the things that it needs to do to defend the UK, how much of a shocker was that report? Certainly in terms of generally and also naval terms.
Yes, the NAO reports did not make for good reading. There's a £16.9 billion shortfall in the equipment plan for the next 10 years. UK defence budget was 2.1% of GDP last year. This is at a period of significant geopolitical flux, with the UK directly confronted by war in Europe, which, if Russia were to win in Ukraine, would very likely lead to a direct threat against NATO and the requirement for Britain to actually be involved in combat. The simultaneous challenge of confronting Iran and its various nefarious actions in the Middle East, the possibility arising that the UK may have to be part of an international response to countering any actions that Venezuela may seek to pursue against a member of the Commonwealth, Guyana, as well as the wider requirements of operating in an international environment characterized by complexity, uncertainty, and great power tensions and rivalries. And that's before we even get to the matter of discussing what happens if Donald Trump or another neo-isolationist Republican wins the US presidential election next year and decides to either undermine the US commitment to NATO or pull out entirely, and takes an avowedly, if not pro-Russian perspective, at least a more compromising, accommodating stance towards Moscow. And for the Royal Navy, it's not able to secure the budget for a third squadron of F-35Bs to operate from our carriers alongside the Royal Air Force, which 265,000-ton aircraft carriers designed each to embark an air group of at least 36 fast jets. You're going to see perhaps with a maximum of 24 at some point in the future, and get funding for the Type 32 frigate and the next generation post Type 45 replacements, the Type 83. And notably, the NAO report mentioned the Future Air Dominance System alongside the Type 83. They had previously been conflated, but the Future Air Dominance System included the Type 83. So that's an interesting choice of phrasing. And perhaps with most relevance to today, the Royal Marines unable to secure £700 million in funding to ensure that they can operate in the high-threat, high-intensity warfighting environment. When one hears the term high-intensity warfighting, you might think of a NATO Article 5 commitment against Russia, but a non-combatant evacuation, say, for example, from Lebanon, again, in the face of a hostile Hezbollah, for example, that would very certainly match the requirements of a high-intensity conflict. The non-state actors that challenge Western interests in the Middle East, those Iranian proxies such as Hezbollah in Lebanon or the Houthis in Yemen, are equipped with land attack and anti-ship cruise missiles, land attack and anti-ship ballistic missiles. They have various unmanned air systems, unmanned small boats, as well as more traditional conventional military capabilities that they've either been supplied with by Iran or acquired within the country that they operate in. So the boundaries between a high intensity war fighting against a state adversary and what you may expect in a non-combatant evacuation operation from a Middle Eastern state that is perhaps in a state of turmoil are becoming quite blurred. So it makes for very disturbing reading that the British government is not taking seriously the immense geopolitical pressures that are confronting us, and the defense budget is staying at what is, you know, given the geopolitical environment, a frankly inadequate amount. And I would suggest that, you know, we cannot fulfill the requirements that government policy sets out, which is for Britain to be an active major power, a contributor to the rules-based international order, without a more significant amount of funding provided to the Ministry of Defence, or to accommodate budgetary requirements, the number of commitments and roles that the UK can perform will have to be reduced. But I don't see that as being politically acceptable.
And what do you think, Gary? What's your take on the NAO equipment plan report?
So my take on the NAO report is that I agree with James. It doesn't make for great reading. Deterrent contingency, it isn't really ring-fenced for enabling technologies and platforms, but in effect, you can't really have a functioning deterrent if you don't have sufficient mine countermeasure capabilities or frigates as well. So it's almost hinting that some of that contingency could be spent on those capabilities, which otherwise might be at risk from cancellation. And yeah, I mean, I fully agree with what James was saying about the fact that it makes absolutely no strategic sense not to put the funding in place. And if we look at our adversaries, if you look at Russia, for example, next year, they'll be spending 6% of their GDP on defence, whilst we'll be spending about 2%. China, the official figure for their defence budget's in the realm of $220 billion, but unofficial estimates put it nearer $700 billion, and the UK is spending about $65 billion. So the threats are only going one way, and therefore it would be grossly negligent for the body politic simply to act as if it were business as usual, or, you know, we were somehow back to the early 1990s when that's patently not the case.
I would say that I think it's quite extraordinary that our political leaders are in some ways still living in the 1990s, a benign environment in the wake of the Cold War. And we're now confronted with multiple threats, sophisticated weaponry. There's going to be no way you can give up commitment. You know, East of Suez in the Gulf, where there's one frigate, a few mine hunters, some Merlin helicopters, and now one destroyer committed, which is not very much when you consider what the UK could do 40 years ago, if not in sophistication, but in terms of resilience and a presence to protect merchant shipping. You've got the likelihood of, or the potential rather, of something going seriously awry in the Eastern Mediterranean. And then there's the situation with Guyana. So Britain is now at a real decisive point. Does it believe in defence? Does it want to support allies? Has it got the wherewithal to actually take some tough decisions with other areas of public spending? I mean, they're all in crisis as well, but it just cannot surely avoid the fact that it needs to raise its defence spending at least to what it was in 2010 and get on with it, because the commitment was there and the money was there for Afghanistan and Iraq, wars of choice, which were, it turns out, pretty misguided and botched. And now we have a really, really direct threat in all sorts of ways to the UK and allies, you know, emanating from the sea, emanating from land, and in the air, and getting ever more sophisticated and serious. And they don't, in my opinion, they're still living in cloud cuckoo land.
And this is in the document. I think it's in the summary that tells us why the problems are the way they are. And the Ministry of Defence is not allowed to step outside of its annual expenditure limits, which might be fine, you know, in an ideal world. But when you're building a warship like the Type 26, for example, it will probably make a lot of logical sense to front load the costs. If that's what the kind of the construction, the build, and the design parameters suggest you should do. But the accounting methodology will not allow them to do that. And as the document says, the inevitable consequence of the way things are currently managed is that capabilities are provided late and they're provided well over budget. And if you stretch out a program exponentially over time, it inevitably will cost more because of the function of inflation. And HMS Glasgow, it's going to take 9 years for Glasgow from the point of it being the keel being laid to the point of it coming into commission will be 9 years. So the costs inevitably inflate. And that's simply, that's a function of the accounting mechanism. And now we could burn through 10 podcasts on defense procurement, I'm sure. But at the end of the day, that is just, that's also going against what you'll recall Sir John Parker's principal recommendation in the National Shipbuilding Strategy a few years ago, was to allow the Navy or the Army or the Air Force, the Navy in this regard, to be able to spend the money, its budget parameter, in a logical way, rather than being beholden to this annual expenditure limit, which creates false economies. So we're shooting ourselves in the foot. So the budgets are inadequate in the round, and even if we had perfect defence procurement, they'd still be inadequate. But there are systemic problems, which actually many commentators miss. They just miss it. And so you get a lot of lamentation about how useless the Ministry of Defence is. And some of it is obviously justified. But actually, you know, the MOD doesn't exist in a vacuum. The finance ministry, the treasury, is the king in this scenario. But then again, to be fair, even to the treasury, you know, that is just another component of the body politic. And so one final point. When you hear members of the defense committee lambasting the various witnesses that give evidence before them, I always have a wry smile on my face because I think, well, actually, ultimately, chaps, it's you who are running the show. So the buck stops with you, which is not to, you know, say that individuals don't make mistakes within organizations. Of course they do. One thinks of Type 45, you know, propulsion system. But the bottom line is that it's the body politic which keeps messing up.
And when you say front load the costs on the frigates, just for our just to benefit of our listeners, how do you mean front load them?
Well, often what you get in defence parlance is the phrase pushing to the right. So pushing to the right means that rather than building something on time, that because of the pressure on the annual budget, the costs are pushed further backwards in time, and so you end up obviously the ship is delayed and it's over budget. Whereas if you bought if you built on a more natural construction timescale, then you can reduce the costs, which actually in the NEO document is what they're saying they're going to do with the Dreadnought class. They're going to make sure it's built on time. So they're almost going in the opposite direction, and they're doing that in order to bear down on inflationary costs. And that's one of the reasons why you have this hole in the budget. But please, can we all just not use this term black hole? Because I cannot bear the prospect of going back to 2010 and listening to all this ill-informed nonsense about black holes in the budget. And I fear that's where we're going to go with this.
Yeah.
And actually that will exacerbate the problem, because you'll get a lot of fiscal hawks standing up in Parliament, grandstanding, saying, well, what we need to do is cut the aircraft carriers, because actually the worst of all worlds would be to have a black hole in the budget, even though a lot of it is just a load of accounting sleight of hand. So I don't know. As James says, we've got all these, and as you've said, Ian, we've got all these external events bearing down on us. Now is not the time to slap ourselves in the face and shoot ourselves in the foot just for the benefit of being able to say, come out with really trite sign bites, such as let's fix the roof while the sun is shining. You remember that one from George Osborne. Actually, we need to be a bit more grown up about these things. And as I said, the best thing I ever read on defence procurement was Sir John Parker's report, The National Shipbuilding Strategy, because he looked at it in the round. He looked at it holistically. And he said, when it comes to shipbuilding, you need to be able to make sure that you're not beholden. You have a 10-year budget rather than a 1-year budget. And if you do it that way, you can build them quicker and you can build them cheaper.
Yeah, and you mentioning 2010, I felt a shiver. Because we all remember with horror the Strategic Defence and Security Review of David Cameron's government, where they did exactly that kind of, you know, let's cut a few prestige things, let's muck the whole of the UK's defence up and wreck all the long-range planning just to say that we've delivered a few savings, which actually don't save very much and don't fix the system that you've been talking about. And of course, we're now at that situation in many ways where this government has run out of road and run out of steam and is likely to be booted out and replaced by a Labour government, which will come in and be confronted with the dreaded, inverted commas, black hole in defence, and also look at the way the UK is configured with its defence forces and their strategic commitments. So I'll start with Gary here, but then go to James as well. But Gary, do you think we're about to see a spot of deja vu here, a bit of back to the future with the Labour government coming in and slashing things despite all the problems we've got bearing down on us with an equivalent of SDSR again, you know?
Well, yes. I mean, they've talked about they're going to do a defence review fairly early on if they get into power. You know, it would be if the idea is to cut the Navy in relation to the IPR, then that's a false choice because it's a pivot. It's a tilt. So it's only we're only talking currently about two OPVs. So there's no great savings there.
And you, sorry to interrupt you, when you say IPR, you mean the tilt to Indo-Pacific region, yeah?
Correct, yeah. I mean, I'm vaguely optimistic that I think the UK has got so much skin in the game in that region now in relation to AUKUS and in relation to the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement. And just the fact that East Asia is so important to the global economy, that I think officialdom would try and talk the Labour Party around on that one is my hunch. It's just a hunch, but there are no savings to be made there currently anywhere. So if the idea is you transfer that to the army and somehow transfer that to NATO. Well, what would you be transferring? You would be transferring very little. The magical thing about navies is their inherent mobility and the fact that, you know, they can be tasked to help with NATO in the Baltic or the North Atlantic one moment and then reprioritize to go and operate off the south in the South Atlantic or the Indo-Pacific region in another moment. So it's a false choice. It's a complete red herring. It might well happen because it fits with political rhetoric, but in reality it would be I think a false choice. The problem with war and strategy and all these things is sometimes it doesn't provide you with the option of a choice. Sometimes you don't get that luxury, and unfortunately we're living in a period, I would say, since 2014. Well, as you said earlier, we're no longer in the wars of choice period. We're in the wars of deterring great powers because the world has become very different. It's become multipolar. So we have no choice. Choices are, I don't think everybody in Parliament or SW1 generally, I don't think that penny's dropped with them. And I do worry precisely when the penny might drop. Hopefully it won't be too late. Hopefully it will happen sooner rather than later.
And what's your take on that, James? Do you think we're heading for a rerun of SDSR with things being cut because it looks good, and to use a crude word, knackering the UK military even more.
You know, I agree with what Gary said, but I am concerned that an incoming Labour government that would be perhaps more pro-European in perspective would look to use perhaps a reinforced commitment to NATO for influence and to move away from the global Britain Brexit aligned shift or tilt to the Indo-Pacific region, which is too far away out of Britain's real area of interest. Yeah, we're back to being a good European power, and so our focus is going to be on Europe. And as there's a big land war underway, perhaps land power would be the name of the game. Although I'm not sure what difference ultimately a reinforced British land commitment would make, considering what the Poles are doing, for example. I mean, our asymmetric edge, our contribution is, and historically has always been, the fact that we are a maritime power. And as Gary explained, you know, the trick of sea power is that, you know, you can have your aircraft carrier strike group or your surface action group or your offshore patrol vessel today in European waters, and in a couple of weeks' time it can be showing the flag in the Indo-Pacific. But when you look at the costs involved in sea power to an uninformed electorate and to policymakers who are looking for quick fixes, big expensive ships are, I would say, vulnerable to cuts. And although I think AUKUS is an excellent initiative, I think it's quite vulnerable. I think there's an awful lot of politics and that's got to happen in all three parties to it, in the United States, Australia, and in London, before we can be certain that AUKUS is going to be a success. And I think as well, given the wider geopolitical dynamics in East Asia, a cynical politician saying to the Navy, so what difference does it make having Britain having ships in the region when look at the Japanese, look at the South Koreans, and what are we going to be doing when the US 7th Fleet is in the region? Surely it makes more sense for us to have all our eggs concentrated in European waters, showing the flag, being a good member of NATO, deterring the Russians, rather than engaging in some either nostalgic nods to old British imperial glory or some sort of post-Brexit global Britain ambition which can't be fulfilled. So the cynic in me is very very pessimistic about the near future.
Yeah, I mean that could happen. I do think that the turn in events in Caribbean, east of Suez, you know, Red Sea around to the Gulf, and the Eastern Mediterranean, and of course the Russians, the Baltic, whatever. The irony is, if you like, that those bad events may in fact finally get that penny to drop, as Gary said, in the politicians' minds, when they see how serious and threatening these events are in those areas. Maybe not Asia, yeah. Indo-Asia Pacific, despite the great work on a limited scale of the offshore patrol vessels, Tamar and Spey out there. You know, the carrier hasn't been there. A carrier strike group hasn't been there since 2021. So there could be, I think you're right, there could be this idea that the Britain should draw its horns in. But I think the crises and the wars that are now raging or may soon be raging in those other areas will actually show the politicians that the Navy needs to be bolstered, it needs to be reinforced, that as a maritime power we have a lot that we can do in conjunction with our allies, particularly the Americans. So that may actually emerge, because it does seem to me that the world is now in the most dangerous spot it's been in for many decades. I don't know to conclude things, if each one of you would give an assessment of that, a brief assessment of that. Are we now in the early stages of something that is going to mutate into an actual new Cold War? Can people argue now there isn't a new Cold War, although it's fairly hot in places, and that we are actually in a major confrontation between the West, and I mean that includes Japan, South Korea, other allies around the world, and the authoritarian arc of resistance, the Russians, the Iranians, etc. Are we now in that Cold War, that confrontation? So what do you think, Gary, to kick off?
I mean, yes, is a short answer. I think we are. It was interesting. I was watching something by Professor Neil Ferguson the other day, famous historian, and maybe he was guilty of being a professional Cassandra, but he seemed genuinely fearful that we were heading towards the worst scenario, particularly in relation to China, actually, and Taiwan. And you know, he was particularly animated about the forthcoming Taiwanese election. I think the problem is that what we've seen actually is that we have these authoritarian powers who are extremely keen to defend what they see as their national interests. But actually, one of the interesting things about Western liberal powers is that they're equally hard-nosed at defending their national interests. So you have an irresistible force meeting an immovable object. The problem, and Ferguson makes this point, many other people have made it as well, is that when it comes to a material preponderance, particularly industrial power, upon which obviously navies, armies, and air force or forces ultimately sit, authoritarian powers have an edge. Their industrial military production capability is higher, so they can fight for longer. Ferguson makes the claim that the US Navy would be out of precision guided munitions after 5 days of a war in and around the Taiwan Strait. And obviously we've seen all the problems the West has had in supplying artillery to Ukraine. So, but from a purely British perspective, I think the Navy may have to play a canny political game. The Joint Expeditionary Force is obviously something that the UK takes a lead on. It's naval and it's European. And of course, we all know that during the First Cold War, the Royal Navy's capital ships were deployed in the North Atlantic. So if the Navy wants to demonstrate its relevance to Europe, it really shouldn't be that difficult to do so. But I'll make one final comment, which is that for an island power like the United Kingdom, without a strong navy, you can't really do an awful lot. You can't get involved in expeditionary warfare on the continent of Europe or in the Persian Gulf in a meaningful way. In extremis, it's highly unlikely, but you can't prevent your island from being invaded. And go back to the events in the Red Sea and the Persian Gulf. They're absolutely essential for your economic well-being. So if one was purely looking at it in cold, hard, strategic logic terms, and I would say this, I guess, but the Royal Navy would have the lion's share, even of a diminished pie, if that's where we're going. But that, I don't know. I've been looking at this stuff for a very long time. And I can't see it any other way. But the Navy may have to play a cunning political game in the next couple of years.
And James, what's your take on that same topic?
I think we are living through one of those major paradigm shifts in the international system and the consequences that come from it. We are shifting from a post-Cold War unipolar moment where the United States was the unassailable great power. We are seeing pushback from Russia. We are seeing the rise of China. And there is, of course, much argument over whether we live in a multipolar international system now or a bipolar international system. But what is agreed upon is that we are going through a major systemic change. And, I completely agree with all of Gary's points. And I would add that in terms of, for example, the connections between security in Europe and security in the Indo-Pacific, the biggest supplier one of the biggest suppliers of 155 millimeter artillery ammunition to Ukraine supplying more rounds than all of Europe combined has been South Korea. And we're also seeing now North Korea becoming a key supplier to Russia. So a land war in Europe has actually an extremely critical Asian component to it. And we must also be prepared for perhaps the most profound shift. The key point since the Second World War, but since 1941 really, has been that the United States is the ultimate guarantor for European security. From the alliance between the UK and the US in World War II, the US's role through NATO and subsequent. But we are seeing the signs that potential domestic factors in the United States will change that. And I think that is perhaps the most consequential factor that we have to think about in the near term. And that is, what are the implications for British defence policy and our various allies in Europe and the Middle East and the Asia Pacific, of if the United States is not that guarantor of the rules-based international order that has kept the peace quite effectively since 1945. And the Joint Expeditionary Force, for example, would be one potential lever in Europe if, for example, NATO was undermined. And if you look at the states that are party to that, you know, you've got good land power, you've got good air power. What would be the UK's contribution? Well, potent maritime power. And if you're looking at, for example, a coalition of like-minded states that wish, that depended on the international maritime trading system, such as Japan, South Korea, and the UK, you would be looking at, again, a maritime-centric conception of security. So in an uncertain geopolitical environment, maintaining flexibility, adaptability, and versatility is absolutely key. And, you know, to any policymaker in London, ultimately that means you're going to have to be looking at the Royal Navy as it always has been, the bulwark of British defence policy.
Well, I hope that some politicians at least tune into the Warships Pod podcast, listen to your wise words, James and Gary. I do think we've got an interesting year coming with the election, and I'm not sure that in the UK, I'm not sure that defence will feature highly at all there as a crucial issue, because it never does, which is quite bizarre, especially in the growing threat scene that's out there. And I do hope that fingers crossed, toes crossed for everything in the coming year. And so thanks very much to both of you for coming on the Warships Pod for a fascinating discussion. For more on the situation in the Red Sea and the response of navies to the Houthi threat with missiles and drones and more, then please take a look at the February 2024 edition of Warships International Fleet Review, which is due to be out there from the 19th of January. Also in the February 2024 edition will be a look at the UK's defence spending challenges. For more Warships IFR, you can visit our website at warshipsifr.com, follow us on Facebook at Warships IFR, and also Twitter at Warships IFR. And we also have a YouTube channel called Warships IFR TV. Thank you for listening, and there will be another episode of the Warships Pod unleashed soon.